parar. Se acabó la diversión, llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York, at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Coming up next, Give Peace a Chance, a special presentation from The World Can't Wait. In an effort to further understanding, the Peace Group has been visiting schools throughout our area with veterans to talk about the experience of being in the military and its aftermath. Recently, The World Can't Wait visited a human rights study class at Nassau Community College out on Long Island. They were kind enough to share the hour with WBAI Radio. Miles Megasif of We Are Not Your Soldiers spoke of his time in the Marines, including when he was in boot camp and when he was stationed in Guantanamo in Okinawa. The students raised a number of interesting questions and made heartfelt comments. Here's Professor Susan Cushman. She's followed by Stephanie Rugoff from The World Can't Wait and Miles Megasif with We Are Not Your Soldiers.
Welcome to Human Rights Studies 105, Introduction to Peace Studies. We have heard excellent presentations about the NAACP, Iraqi Veterans Against the War About Face, Seeds of Peace, Food Not Bombs, Long Island Alliance for Peaceful Alternatives, SWAN, Service Women Action Network, and Code Pink. We are going to hear more about Doctors Without Borders, Nassau County Safe Center, and Holocaust Memorial and Tolerance Center. Today, we will learn about an organization named World Can't Wait. I'm so thrilled to welcome Miles Megasif and Stephanie Rugoff from this group, a U.S.-based group that formed in response to the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and the government-sanctioned war crimes that took place there. One peace project they work on is to support former veterans' voices, narratives, and art as they process their former military experience, which may or may not have included combat. They provide schools and colleges an opportunity to host these veterans in classes and to offer students a range of perspectives on militarism and war. Here at Nassau, the Veterans Club is our largest club on campus, and therefore we are pleased to host events and special classes like this one where we can spotlight veterans' voices and experiences. So I'm thrilled to welcome Stephanie and Miles to our class.
Thank you very much, Professor Cushman. Thank you, students, for having us in this class. What a wonderful class where these kind of ideas and organizations are discussed, and there's an exchange of views between among the students who have had certain experiences and various organizations. That's just great. And that's just the kind of thing that we feel is so important, knowing about, to learn about U.S. history and U.S. wars and using critical thinking, which is exactly what it seems this class is doing, finding out the facts and hearing different points of view so that you for yourself can figure out what's really going on. So check out what you hear today in this presentation. Make sure for yourself that these are the facts. You don't have to believe us just because we're here in your classroom. Do your own research to see if what we have presented is accurate. But we ask you to do the same for what you hear in the regular news or see on TV or see online or hear on the radio or movies. Before we begin, we'd like to know a little more about you. Is there anyone in this class who has family or close friends that are currently in the military? If you can raise your hand or put it into the chat.
Kayla with the cat.
It looks like Kayla and Eileen.
Ah, okay. And are they there now? Where are they now based?
Germany.
Germany. Uh-huh. And same with Eileen?
No, my brother is right now he's stationed in Texas.
All right. And do any of you have family that are veterans or close friends who are veterans? Professor Cushman, Oh, Michael and Jolene. Okay, even more people. Okay, did you want to say anything about them? Oh, okay. And has anyone been in a war situation yourself? No. Okay. And anyone in the class considering enlisting? No. Okay. So anyway, I don't even have to say it. We're living through very difficult times. And, you know, education is so expensive and living costs are so expensive. So that a lot of people enlist based on those considerations. But it's a very, very major decision and can do a lot to people, both physically and emotionally. And also there's the consideration of what happens to the people in the countries that are being occupied. But whether or not we're in the military or not, all of us as people living in this country, where we're already at war in 7 countries, each of us has a responsibility to educate ourselves and make our views known. During Miles's presentation, there's a word that we want you to think about throughout, which is morality. Knowing the difference between right and wrong in the largest sense, and what do you do if you know something is wrong. We want this to be a discussion. So at any time, if you have a question, a comment, a disagreement, please speak up, either raise your hand and speak, or you can put it in the chat and then we'll read your question or your comment out loud. I'm going to put into the chat our contact information. So I'll put World Can't Wait, this project, We Are Not Your Soldiers, that is the project with the veterans, Veterans for Peace, which is the organization Miles works with, and his website where you can hear more of his music and see more of his videos. So, okay, that's it for me. And now here is Miles Megasife.
Peace and plenty, y'all.
So much promise, promise to say it loud. I promise to spit fire only to control the crowd. In the years since I've been out, I've done a world of things, made a world of difference to some future kings and queens. Impressed a ton of people, but still seeking it myself. After that family crossed the minefield, there's all or nothing else. That night, my soul went to hell and back. When babies hanging barbed wire were ordered to hold back. What holds us back from breaking orders? What keeps us from breaking rank to hold obscure borders? These are broad questions with pinpoint answers. Why are people persecuted for smoking the cure for cancer? Why global greenhouse emissions still not addressed? Why incarcerate instead of educate? I'm not impressed. We're oppressed with fear, scared of change or the other. Allowed our government to become big brother. Was it a big blunder, a grand mistake or fate? Though I've walked through the valley of death, I am awake. Forever promised to the few and the proud. So much potential I could hold the clouds. So much promise, promise to say it loud. I promise to spit fire only to control the crowd. Forever promise to the few and the proud. So much potential I could hold the clouds. So much promise, promise to say it loud. I promise to spit fire only to control the crowd.
So that is, thank you. Thank you. That song Promise is me attempting to convey how my mom felt when I left, and my realization that she was right and I shouldn't have gone in the first place. She wasn't able to articulate why, because she hadn't been in the military. Everything in that song is true. I don't know if you've read the lyrics already, but you can ask me questions about the song. You can ask me questions about my time in the military. I joined the Marine Corps immediately after high school. I was 18. I graduated high school with a 1.79 grade point average, like a D average. I was kind of pushed out of the school due to racism and my grades weren't accepted when I moved from New York to Atlanta as a incoming junior in high school. And a lot of credits were taken from me. So I started behind. And then my teachers, I went from a majority black school in Brooklyn to a majority white school in Atlanta in 1990. And my teachers did not really recognize me or see me. And I couldn't articulate this then, but I suffered greatly because of it. And the Marine Corps seemed like a logical option at the time. I hadn't been given a political education. And I was quickly disillusioned and left to try to figure things out. It took me a long time to do that. And that song you just heard was written, this is given context, that song you heard was written 17 years after I got out. I got out in 1996, and that song was written in 2013. So is that good math? It's about 17 years after I got out. And I wrote the song because my son Tafari had been born in 2012, and me and my wife had moved, my wife and I had moved to Kansas, and I found myself at home for the first time as an adult without a job, raising a son, dealing with almost two decades of suppressed pain. And I was gonna raise him like he was in boot camp. And I realized it was wrong somehow, thankfully. And started writing Civil I Am, came up with the idea for it, reached out to my producers. I hit them with this document of ideas, and they hit me with tracks, and then I started writing. And that's where Promise came from. So every time we do these classes, it's different. And please ask me questions. I will cry, but it's okay. I'm at a point in my life where the tears don't shut me down. It just means I'm breaking through a new layer.
Thank you, Miles, for sharing. Thank you, and you're free to cry here in this space.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I realized I should have said something in the intro that when several of you have family members in the military and veterans in your family, that these are very, very difficult things to talk about. Even if some of them or all of them have had similar experiences, they're very difficult to share. And so you may not have heard these things. And maybe this will give you a way to speak to those family members in a different way to enable them to be able to talk about some of this.
Thank you. Do any of the students have any questions at this time for Miles or Stephanie? Go ahead, Eileen. Thank you.
I have a question for Miles. I don't know if this is too personal, but do you consider yourself to have PTSD after joining the Marines?
Yes.
Good question.
Yes, I certainly do. I'll tell y'all right now, nothing is too personal on this call. You can ask me literally anything about my life. If it's too personal, I'll just refuse to answer, you know, but you can ask me anything. Because your recruiter won't answer things. If you have a recruiter, or if your family is talking to somebody, or if your friends are talking to a recruiter, there's things they won't answer. So yeah, I definitely have PTSD. I still have it. I've never been diagnosed, but the definition of it, post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Like, when you go into boot camp, when you go into the military, you are subject to incredible amounts of stress. Your stress test is met. Whoever you are, whichever man, woman you are, whatever branch you are, your stress test is met in boot camp. The majority of the trauma that military, that veterans experience is brought on in boot camp. It's compounded if they go to combat, if they see a war, a combat situation, but it happens in boot camp. That is where they break you out of being a civilian and turn you into a soldier, or turn you into a machine for the Imperial forces. You have to think like a killer to kill. And so that is taught to you in boot camp. I was a Marine. That was taught to us in boot camp. I would imagine it's the same in all of the forces, because you are the vanguard of this weapon in the world. So like when you get to boot camp, you're treated far less than human, and it continues until boot camp ends. Maybe on the last day or the last 2 days, your drill instructors might show themselves to be human. But until then, they're barking at you or somebody next to you directly in your face. If this microphone is you, their face is like this. They are touching you. They'll do everything they can possibly to antagonize you, short of abusing you, because those, like, physically abuse, like punching you and kicking you, because that right has been taken from them. Yes, Susan.
Yeah, thanks, Miles. Just to follow up, so would you say that your PTSD came as early as boot camp? Because I noticed in your lyrics to Promise, you said you never killed a man, and I realize that's a very personal question, so I don't mean to even ask that, but it sounds to me like you're suggesting that the trauma can start as early as boot camp. Is that, would that be true?
Yes. Like I'm being vague. So when you get off the bus, when you arrive, like I took a bus from Atlanta to Parris Island, South Carolina. And when I got off the bus, when I was yelled off of the bus by the heavy who came on the bus, we're told to line up. We grab our duffel bags from underneath the truck and we line up with them, and then we dump those into a room. And this is at the receiving center in Parris Island. We dump those into a room, and then you begin like an intake process that's like prison. So you have to strip off your clothes get bagged up, and you're naked, and you do a full body cavity search. This is welcome to boot camp. You know, you're being screamed at as well for going too slow. You're being called, excuse me, everybody, excuse me, but you are being called every name in the book. You know, I know we're being recorded and you want to share this, so I'm not going to do it, but you are being called every single possible name you can imagine. Your mother is being called out of her name. Your sister is being called out of her name. And the drill instructors are already telling you that they have violated the women in your life that you love. And you're moving too slow. And it's because you are a vagina. You know what I'm saying? They don't say that. They call you a P-U-S-S-Y. You know what I'm saying? And add on a A-S-S and a B, because that's what you are. And you're a maggot, and you're scum, and you're bottom of the barrel. And you're here because you couldn't make it anywhere else. And if you want to make it, this is the only way you're going to make it through. You're welcome to the crucible. Welcome, like, that's not the crucible yet, but welcome to the cauldron, man. Welcome to the fire. So you go from there, you get your uniform, and you're brought into an intake room, and there's 30 other recruits in the room, 40 other recruits, and there's a bunch of rooms, you know, like two buses might arrive at a time or something. And you're given whatever whatever paperwork you're doing or whatever testing is being done takes place over the course of 2 to 3 days, with being told to drink water constantly, being barked at you about every hour, and you have to drink a quart of water to the point where you vomit. The reason you have to vomit is because you are a maggot. You're scum, and you came here loaded with drugs or alcohol, and you can't bring that civilian life into this Marine Corps. So,
and does boot camp work differently across the branches? Is it, I know that it's particularly strict in the, I've heard in the Marines, but I guess that's like a two-part question. Is it this way for the Army and for the, you know, Navy? And then kind of the piggyback question to that is, can you conceive of an alternative way? I mean, I hope there's a better way to train servicemen and women that doesn't involve reducing them, their humanity that way. I'm just curious if you think that there's an alternative way, since the military won't be going away anytime soon, right? So how do we make it better? How do we make it more dignified? How do we make it more humane?
So my answer is the first part, I would imagine it's pretty much the same across the services, because my comrades have said that they had similar experiences. Maybe not as extreme as the Marines, but tough.
Yeah.
Dehumanizing. Called out of your name, threatened, you know, things like this by the people who are training you. So, and then the second part, can you have a better way of having a training a military? My answer to that is we don't need a standing military. I do believe it can go somewhere, and I do believe it can go somewhere quick. This whole generation, this group of 9 students represents roughly, and I'm guesstimating, for this year, probably 20% of the people that we've spoken to. Over the years, with all the other people who are doing this work, we've spoken to thousands of young people. And so, I know that there's a generation of people right now who are aware that the military is not benefiting their society. So I think that it can be done away with quickly. I don't think that you have to dehumanize people in order to make them willing to defend themselves and their loved ones. But I do think that you have to dehumanize them to make them kill without question and to accept orders to kill without question. I do think that is that's you have to create a vacancy. You have to create a void within people that you can then fill with hatred in order to get them to pull a trigger without question. Because once you pull the trigger, and no, I haven't killed anybody, but once you pull the trigger or once you assist in the trigger being killed or defend the person who did it, you lose a part of yourself that you never get back.
Thank you, Miles. I think Cindy has a question. Go ahead, Sin. And then Mike.
How did you imagine the military life before joining?
My recruiter told me it was a pleasant experience. You know, I joined in a time when the country wasn't at war. And since you've been alive, pretty much, I'm not saying your age, but since you've been alive, the country's been at war. And so you kind of think it's normal. And also, since you've been alive, there have been games and movies showing extreme violence and gore. So you have been desensitized to it since a very young age. When I joined, those things weren't the way they are now. Like, yes, the U.S. had been in continual wars, but we weren't in a war at the time. The level of the technology was not like what it was not like it is now. So I imagined that the military was a place where people trained and worked out and read and learned about combat, and lived a life. I thought it was just their job because that's how my recruiter pitched it to me. And then you lived a life the rest of the day. But when you talk, when you talk about war all the time and you talk about fighting all the time and death and it's involved in the taking of other people's resources, because that's what the U.S. military really is. It's not just about fighting to defend. The military is an arm of an imperial empire. That's what the U.S. military is. And once you're in, you realize that. So I had no idea that I was taking part in, like, you know, it's like y'all have all seen Star Wars, right? When you are in the U.S. military, you're on Darth Vader's team. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of us identify like hip hoppers, and I'm a rapper. So this is unique. And Michael, I see you with a question. You know, rappers identify with Darth Vader because it's the anti-American, right? Anti-imperial, and the imperial system has forever been against the black man in America. So a lot of black rappers identify with that bad persona. That's the reason behind that, you know? But when you are a stormtrooper, it's not cool. It's not cool to be a stormtrooper. You know what I'm saying? It might be cool or seem cool to rap about it or portray it in a movie, but to be it in real life, to be in another country and realize what you're doing, what you're taking part in, is not a good feeling. It's really not. Michael.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mike.
I just want to ask, did you find it hard to get support, whether you, while you were in active service or even after? And was music like your kind of way of getting your voice out there and being heard?
I think that was a great question. I think music kept me sane while I was in. I wasn't trying to put music out consciously. You know, it took years after I got out to realize what it took to get music out into the world. I'm still learning that, still trying to figure it out. But the music, I had my mentor, his name was IQ, and the music for me was an outlet. I vented a lot of anger through my music. I was a very angry rapper because of all the things that I was living through, you know. Got a 12 gauge Mossberg pump for that app. Like it was all like gun bars, everything. And that allowed me to not act it out like some of my fellows did, you know. But there you go again. It's like good cop, bad cop, right? Like what makes the difference? I sold weed in the Marine Corps. I had friends who did a lot of other stuff, a lot worse. You know, I got in multiple fights in the Marine Corps, you know, well over a dozen. Well, like probably like, I don't know. And you don't think about that as something that you're going to do. You know, you don't think about the drug culture of the military as the life that you're about to live when you join. You don't realize that everybody in your platoon is going to be either in the evening, either going to be drinking, smoking, sniffing, shooting up, crazy. You know what I'm saying? And it's not Vietnam, but the drug culture is there and it's heavy. I know that Elaine, I think, said she has family in Texas. Are they at Fort Hood by chance?
To be honest, I don't know where it is, but I know that it's near the border of Mexico.
There are notorious bases in the U.S. You know, like Fort Hood, there's over 20, I think 20 something people have been disappeared this year. Like 20 something active duty army women and men disappeared from a U.S. military base for speaking out, for being outspoken, for being, you know, for defending their human right to self, for believing in their self, their right of self-preservation, for standing up for themselves. They have lost their lives, their families have lost them, and these people enlisted into the military. They chose to do what we think, what most Americans think of as service. So they didn't think about that, you know. They didn't think that was going to happen to them. It's a horrible system that is lying to the American people. And I know I shouldn't be saying that outright like that, but that's the basic truth. With over 800 bases and the majority of our like 16% of the discretionary spending of the actual budget, 56% of discretionary budget going to the military, the people of the country are being robbed.
You're listening to Give Peace a Chance on WBAI Radio. Miles Megasif of We Are Not Your Soldiers visiting a human rights class at Nassau Community College on Long Island with the World Can't Wait's Stephanie Rugoff.
Stephanie, you have...
There are two questions in the chat that are actually related questions.
Can I just, before we get to those, thank you, if I just could follow up on something that Miles said just before we get off that topic, and I did see the students in the chat, we'll get to the drug culture, the fighting that you were that you said is so prevalent in the military. I just wonder, it may be a naive question, but how does that go on? How does the military does not come down on it? There are no repercussions for it. I'm trying to reconcile that. And I'm not naive to the point where I know this doesn't happen, because I think in the beginning of the class, I mentioned that I have a good friend that survived Vietnam. And it took him years to open up before he could talk about it as well. And I also learned about the drug culture and the fighting culture, but I guess I've never asked him. So it's an opportunity for me to ask you, why is there no repercussions on that? And does it go hand in hand with kind of not really caring about the whole person who's in the military serving? Because it doesn't sound very caring to not come down on those kinds of rules, to allow that to happen, so that your lives are in jeopardy, in fact. And as we know in Vietnam, when people were strung out on tranquilizers or whatnot, they were not always able to keep safe. So I'm just curious about that, if you don't mind, and then we'll go on.
Yeah. I'll preempt it by saying most people won't speak about their experiences because they carry moral guilt. They carry shame about being involved in it, having done it. You can be outlandish in your aggression in the military and celebrated if you are a good, on the paper, soldier. If you don't, as long as you pass on paper, it doesn't matter what you're doing in the world, because all you are is a machine. You're a machine. You're a tool of the empire. And so as long as you do that official duty and you do it well, so what? So what? He's a great soldier. She's a great soldier. You know what I'm saying? Have you seen her shoot on the firing range? We don't care that she's running a prostitution ring. We don't care that he's running a gun and drugs ring. We don't care that he abducts women. We don't care that, you know what I'm saying? Like, they overlook it. It gets overlooked. My staff sergeant popped for cocaine abuse, the same test that I popped for weed. So I did 3 years, 8 months, 6 days, 10 hours in the Marine Corps. 3 years and 4 months of it was honorable, perfectly honorable. I failed a urinalysis, and I got disrespectful with my commanding officer at office hours, and I got sent to the brig for a month. Prison. Like, the military brig is prison. Open squad bay, 20 plus beds, maybe 40 beds in the squad bay, 6 showers, everything open, prison, gates, bars, lining up to go to chow, and then 3 months in a boot platoon on my way out with other than honorable orders. In that boot platoon, I was in CACS, live fire training in California. Since they were kicking me out with an OTH, they weren't putting a rifle in my hands. This was live fire training. This is the training where you go out in the desert and you're playing war games and you're shooting rounds over each other's heads and they're dropping grenades within 25, 50 meters of your platoon mates, right? Controlled detonations for live fire training. And there, a boot Marine got disrespectful with me one day in the chow line. I'm serving chow because I'm on my way out. You know what I'm saying? I'm in my last 3 months. I'm with 3-4. This boot, these Marines who just are fresh out of boot camp. I've already been to Okinawa. I've been to Cuba. I've been in numerous fights. I've grown exponentially in the mindset of violence, and this boot gets violent with me in the chow line about his food, and so it's on. We already know that at the end of the day the fight's going to happen. It's a created scene out of a movie. There's people on both sides. We're like pitted against each other. The whole base saw it. Y'all understand what I'm saying? They knew what was about to happen. Maybe they were hoping he would beat me. But we got in a fight and I tore off this man's I tore a hole in his face with my elbow that exposed his teeth. Okay? And I knew what I was gonna do when I did it. You see what I'm saying? And I carry that with me. And was anything done to me? Nothing. Nothing was done to me for destroying this man's face in like 10 seconds because it was a lesson for him. Like his platoon, his sergeant, see, he has years to go. And that probably made him more violent. That probably made him deadly. You know, I don't know how his life developed after that, but I know that I left him with a chunk of flesh hanging off. And nothing was done to me.
Whoa, okay. That's a heavy story to process, but we appreciate your sharing it so that we can have kind of an inside view of something that we didn't even remotely study that in the class, you know, and it's a view that I can't offer because I don't have it. So that's part of why it's important that we hear your view. Sardis, welcome. You joined in the class. I'm glad to have you. And anyone else?
So basically my question was like through like the whole boot camp, like what kept you going and like what kept you, I know you said like your songs kept you sane like after, but like during that time while you experienced it, like what kept you like going through all that and not quit out of it?
Just while you're at it, the second question is kind of related to it. So maybe you could do both together, because the other one was how did you deal with that kind of impact of the boot camp and your PTSD? And I just wanted to add in quickly about moral injury, that a lot of people consider PTSD a kind of moral injury, which is a lot of what Miles has been talking about.
Thank you, Stephanie.
So I said earlier that my mom didn't raise me with a political education, but she did raise me with a very strong, I had a strong social structure at the house, right? Even though it was a single mom, I was also an only child. And she went out of her way to give me love and support. So I went into boot camp with self-confidence already. I wasn't I was finding who I was, but I wasn't, I wasn't lost. Like I was my father wasn't in my life, but I wasn't hopeful for him kind of thing. I wasn't like, I think I was already strong. My mom made a strong man. I don't know how I made it through, honestly, other than that. I think it was my mom's support, throughout my childhood, because I cracked. I wasn't the same. I'm not the same person who I went into boot camp as. I definitely have a switch that's easily triggered. And maybe that's a point that I still have to find, is how I made it. That's a really good question. I don't know how I made it through boot camp, beyond the love of my mom. We got letters. We had that semblance of life where we would get letters. There's no phone calls. So care packages, I think. You know, we had Marines who were raped in boot camp. There were two guys in my unit who were raped. There were 75 of us when we started, and there were less than 40 when we finished, like less than half. It was like 33, 34 people or something. I saw people cycled through that broke my heart. It's like, I saw people treated like absolute crap. And I had a growth spurt. I was lucky. I was 5'10", 135 when I went in, and I was 6'2", 195 when I got out of boot camp in 3 months. I gained 60 pounds of weight. I looked and I was just big. I went in strong. I trained for the whole summer with my man Stan. I was better than the PFT. I was doing more than 80 sit-ups in 2 minutes, more than 20 pull-ups, and I ran faster than 18 minutes, 3 miles. I graduated boot camp. I couldn't do any of that anymore because I was now big, but I was strong. And so maybe that growth spurt, like, shocked my drill instructors. I don't know. I doubt to think that that's the reason. But I was different when I came out. Yeah, I saw somebody's hand up, I think. Susan? No?
I didn't have a hand up. Did anybody else have a question?
Kayla had her hand up.
Kayla, go ahead, hon.
My question is, for the story you talked about, the fight, do you think that action still happens without a punishment today?
Most definitely it does. If the person who's doing the fighting is not worth punishing, they're not going to punish them. If it's somebody that is frowned upon in the unit, if it's somebody who's too outspoken, if it's somebody who questions their superiors, they're going to get punished for fighting. If it's somebody who aligns with the system, they won't get punished. There's so much domestic abuse. There's so much child abuse. There's so much spousal abuse that happens in the military. It's horribly sad. Like, literally, it is an organization built on violence. And so what comes out of it is violence. And the only things that are punished are things that speak against it. So people don't do what I'm doing because the movies that we watch are true, and people get silenced. People get disappeared. You know, people don't do what I'm doing because they feel they did it themselves. They feel, how can I speak out against it when I was part of it? And so that's the moral injury. That's the moral guilt. Yes.
So it's obviously disturbing to hear this, and particularly on behalf of my students. I don't have any friends or family currently serving in the military, but for those that do, I guess my question for you, Miles, is how can we from the outside be in touch with our family or friends that are serving in the military to be sure that this is not happening to them. Because I don't want to alarm anyone. And I know you're not intending to, you're just telling us how you experienced it. And I believe you. And I know a lot of what I've heard so much of what you're saying before personally, but my students may not have. So I guess my question is twofold. One, are recruits and boots, as you call them, given the opportunity to bug out if they're not able to so-called handle it, even though we know that none of us should be able to handle the treatment that you describe? But I want to make sure that there's an out for people. And if there isn't, what can we do as civilians from the outside to be sure that our loved ones aren't being treated this way?
There's organizations like GI Rights Hotline that people who are currently serving can reach out to for legal aid, legal advice, and help. They can reach out to World Can't Wait, of course. They can reach out to Veterans for Peace, About Face. There's lots of veteran organizations and peace organizations that are focused on demilitarization as a whole, as a way to achieve a peaceful world, who can put veterans and active duty military in touch with the right people to help them. And this is to help them deal with the stress that they are undergoing, or to figure out how to leave. It's not easy to leave the military. It's called going AWOL, absent without leave. If you leave base without permission, you know, unless you live off of base, you basically, you know, wake up and work and go to sleep and live your life on a base. You can go out into the civilian town around base during the day, but at night you need to be in your squad bay and, you know, or your barracks. And in the morning you need to be there at formation. So if you're not there, unless you're on vacation, you're absent without leave. And if you're absent without leave, you're going to get locked up. You're going to go to jail.
Thank you. I see Stephanie had put some good, everybody, you can see in the chat, Stephanie put, for legal advice and help, aside from the above organizations, there's GI Rights Hotline, like Miles said. And then here's a website, couragetoresist.org. That's good for us to know. And I didn't, and you know, Mike did a great presentation on About Face, and he did definitely mention the veterans. And you might have mentioned, Mike, that organization is also serving active military personnel, which I don't know if I was aware of that. So that's really good to reinforce. You know, I think Carmel has another question. Go ahead, Carmel.
Really quickly, I would just say what we can do as civilians is we can look at where our money is going. We can look at how our money is being spent, and we can invest and intentionally spend money into peace rather than war. So change your stock investments, change your stock portfolios, change all of that if you have that. You know, change where you spend your money. You know, which companies are you spending money with? Are they part of the war economy? And how can you do work if it's not money? How can you do work that works against the war economy?
Thanks. Go ahead, Carmel.
My other question was, like, by estimate, how many, like, people do you think that get out the military, either after boot camp or, like, finish their service, go to see, like, help, like, more like therapy help?
I imagine the number to be low. While you're in, it's kind of frowned upon to get psychological help. It's like, it's not, you know, you're supposed to wear it like a badge of honor. You're supposed to be proud of what you did, and you carry it to the grave, whatever you might have done. That's the honor. That's the code, right? That's the honorable thing to do. So I think a lot of people don't seek help, unfortunately. We have a horrible epidemic in this country of 20 plus veterans a day committing suicide. I deal with episodes, I'd say once a year, unfortunately. It's been that way for my whole adult life, and I've only realized in this past year what I've been dealing with. It was 2 years ago. I had a convention in Chicago with Veterans for Peace, and the conversations helped me realize what I've been going through. And then my wife and I have been actively working to keep me healthy and whole. I have a beautiful workspace here. I create art every day. I create music all the time. And so that keeps me grounded and whole. And, you know, it's a living, it's like being AA. It's like being, you know, a recovering alcoholic. You have to, I constantly have to see, my aggression as an extension of what I was taught in the military rather than as, you know, the informed love, vibration, conscious connection that I choose to live on. They're not the same. The aggression and the anger is not part of what this collection of people on the planet is. It's been fed to us. It's been taught to us, put in us, put upon us. It's a fear paradigm. And, you know, it's easy to react to things or to respond to things out of fear and get angry and get loud. It takes courage and presence to be able to breathe and respond compassionately and intentionally and give people peace that they deserve. So it's a lot more to answer your question about what could we do instead of training people to kill? How could we not dehumanize them? How could we have a military that doesn't do that? And what can we as American citizens do is we could have a military that trains in peace. We could train our military about systems of earth, of earth recognition and water reclamation, you know what I'm saying? And water worshiping, because water is life. We could teach people who want to enlist in the military how to build geothermal domes to harness the earth's heat and solar panels and wind turbines so that the bases around the planet could open their doors and the people around those bases could enter and basically have free universities that learn how to promote a better, healthier earth. That would be a way that we could keep the military budget what it is and give back to the planet. We could give back to our future generations and the rest of the world, because rather than taking resources with a scarcity fear model, we could be sharing them and growing generations of world changers.
Since we're right at the end now, and what you just said really transitions into your last song, because we didn't really get to talk about what happens when the U.S. military goes to other countries, and what you've talked about all this time, the internal part gets externalized onto other people in other places, that this might be just the right time to do Nucci Dutakara.
This song, though, Stephanie, might require a little bit of context for us, if you or Miles could explain Okinawa and what the song's about before we hear it. So to really more fully appreciate it, that would be great.
So I was stationed in Okinawa from 1994 until 1995. I was stationed in Okinawa from 94 to 95. I was there when a young 12-year-old girl was raped by two Marines and one sailor. The Marines were from my base, Camp Schwab, in the northernmost base in Okinawa. The only thing further north of us on the main island of Okinawa is the northern training area, which I forget the percentage, but makes about 40%, 30% of the main island unusable because it's got unexploded ordnance on it, because we used to use it to drop mortars. I was a mortarman. So we used to use it to shoot mortar rounds, heavy artillery. Some of those things haven't exploded over the years. And so that area of land is still unusable to the Okinawan people. Mind you, this is an island that people actively live on. The island takes up, the bases on the island take up, I want to say 15% of the island. And this is where Japan, Okinawa is like Japan's South Bronx, you know, it's kind of like where they put all of the military bases. Some 97% of the military bases that are in Japan are in Okinawa, and Okinawa is but 0.6 of the land mass of Japan. And Okinawa was an independent nation until Japan annexed it. And so that's some context for the song. Luchidu Takara means all life is precious. And the Okinawan people have been resisting the American presence ever since the Battle of Okinawa, which took place in World War II. You can look up the Battle of Okinawa on YouTube. There are plenty of videos. It's the bloodiest battle of the Pacific.
Long before America was born, this became the Ryukyu nation, predating by more than 400 years imperialist Japanese annexation. Then U.S. offensives came to fight and kill, and this island was taken in the Battle of Okinawa, away from the country of the rising sun. Now busting big guns is still done, often makes civilians anxious. This situation simply one of ethnic oppression, let's just face it. For the seven generations coming, their views and imaginations, and all the lives unnecessarily taken opposing these occupations. Nuchi du takara, Nuchi du takara, no nu fitema, Hanogobe feeds us. Nuchi du takara, Nuchi du takara, any means you measure. Okinawa is all together. Nuchi du takara, Nuchi du.
Thanks, y'all. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
That was powerful.
Much love. I want to say all love and praise to the men and women who are in the military. This is not an affront against you. I love you. I honor you. I respect you. Just like the men and women who are serving in the police stations across the country. This is about the systems of oppression, the military-industrial complex, and these systems of racism and oppression that are hurting and killing people. And be brave and ask your family questions, and be compassionate, and give them space and grace in their answers.
You've been listening to Give Peace a Chance on WBAI Radio. Miles Megasif of We Are Not Your Soldiers spoke of his time in the Marines with students from a human rights study class at Nassau Community College. He was accompanied by Stephanie Rugoff from The World Can't Wait. Many thanks to The World Can't Wait and to Nassau Community College and Professor Susan Cushman for allowing WBAI to broadcast this very important class on peace. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.